Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. What is it about the words that we speak that convey concepts, ideas, nuances, and sometimes even start wars? Where do they come from? What is their history? And how do they shape our minds and ability to communicate? Well, that's some of the discussion of Radio Curious in this edition. When we visit with Professor John McWhorter of Columbia University, the author of Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. I spoke with Professor McWhorter from his home overlooking Manhattan. He lives in New Jersey. On December 5th, 2008, and we began our conversation when I asked him, where does language come from? John McWhorter, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk about language and where language comes from. I am starting with the assumption that we give sounds identifications, and those identifications have to do with things in our individual world.
Right.
So you talk about the effect of grammar on how language is put together. The structure of the sentences that you and I are now using.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, no one knows how language arose originally. No one knows how it was that people came up with a sequence of sounds to correspond to something like soil. Like, it's one thing to maybe bark to imitate a dog, but most things do not lend themselves to that kind of imitation, and we're not sure. But what we do know is that a language is not only the words. The words are interesting, but a language isn't just a bucket of words. You have to know how to put the words together, what order to put them in, what endings to use on them. And there are a lot of words that are not a matter of a meaning that you could say, but they just are kind of traffic cops. They indicate where things are supposed to go. They indicate nuances in how we think. So if you say something like, I just didn't know where to go, try explaining to a foreigner what just means. And so language is all about that sort of thing, too. And so in Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, I try to get across that the history of English is not only that Old English took on a bunch of words from French and Latin. That's one story, but it's been told often. But it's also that our grammar changed, the way we put the words together, and in ways that are more interesting than I think has often been shared with the general public.
For example,
Old English was a language that was a lot like German. If we learn it today, then we're approaching a completely foreign language. And the pathway from Old English to Modern English is two main threads. First of all, people who spoke Celtic languages like Welsh seasoned English, and so they ended up speaking a kind of English that was full of Welsh grammar, and we're still using it today because that was so prevalent. And then, right around that same time, Scandinavian Vikings invaded England, and they didn't only leave words behind, but they learned this English in an incomplete way. And there were so many Vikings who learned the language in this way that that began to be the way kids learned English. And so today what we're speaking is a mixture between Old English and Old Welsh, basically, and then that broken down into a kind of a classroom version of Old English, which is now the only kind anybody speaks.
You're saying our conversation now is a classroom version of Old English?
That is exactly what I'm saying in terms of the fact that our grammar is less complicated than the grammar of Old English in a great many ways.
So what effect, then, does grammar have on the way we think?
Well, you know, there is a theory that the grammar of a language, the way we put the words together, the rules, have a way of making a person think about certain things more than people who speak another language. And so, for example, if in a language like French there are two words for to know, one of them is savoir, for knowing a fact, and one of them is connaître, for knowing a person, the idea is that that might mean that the difference between knowing a fact and knowing a person is more vivid to a French speaker than it is to an English speaker. And that doesn't sound very intuitive, and yet that hypothesis, which is often called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, based on the people who first formulated the theory, gets around. It's taught in anthropology classes and language classes, and it's an interesting idea, but I don't think it holds up. A lot of research has shown that in its basic form, it does not hold up the way it was portrayed by its originators. And so there's one chapter I have in the book where I show that if that idea were true, then it would mean that we think in a very different way than old English speakers, because our grammar is so different. And specifically, it would mean that we are less alive to distinctions in the world than an old English-speaking illiterate villager, because old English, despite whatever its speakers were like, had gender on its nouns. It had three different genders, just like many European languages we use. You had to use hither and thither. They weren't optional, and they weren't archaic, and so I sit here, but I go thither, and that was a distinction you had to make. You couldn't say go there. And there were all sorts of things in old English that we do not attend to in the modern language. And I don't think any of us would think that the illiterate old English-speaking villager was somehow a more alert creature than we are alert creatures in modern English. And so it's one of many things that shows that that idea that grammar shapes thought does not hold water the way we're off.
I hear a distinction here. One is grammar, which, again, an assumption on my part, that grammar is the form of structure of a sentence.
Right.
And when you use the two examples of no in French or in Spanish, saber y conocer, those are words.
That's true.
As opposed to grammar and the formulation of the sentence.
Oh, sure, yeah. There, I use that because it's of most immediate appeal to somebody who's thinking about language, because we're often trained to think of words. And when people put forth the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, they use differences in words as much as grammar. But a grammatical example would be something like, in Mandarin Chinese, you can say, if you see my sister, you'll know she's pregnant. And when you render that sentence, it's the exact same sentence as if you said, if you had seen my sister, you would have known she was pregnant. And so in Mandarin Chinese, you don't have to mark the distinction between those two things. And it has been said that that must mean some sort of difference between the way Mandarin Chinese speakers process the hypothetical than English speakers. That's the sort of thing that's said when grammar is referred to.
You ran over that rather quickly, and could you parse out that distinction?
Sure. If you say, if you see my sister, you'll know that she is pregnant. And so that's saying, if something does happen in the future, then here's something that I know will happen for you. Then there's something that is more a matter of the unknown, where you're saying that if something had happened, it hasn't, but if it had happened, I speculate. And so if you said, if you had seen my sister, you would have known that she was pregnant. That's a different sentence than if you see my sister. That is, if you do see my sister, you will know that she's pregnant. In Mandarin Chinese, the same sentence is used to convey both of those English sentences, despite the fact that there's a difference in meaning. They just rely on the context. Some people would say that that means that the Mandarin Chinese speaker has a different sense of how the world works and whether something is true and whether something isn't than an English speaker. And I think a lot of people have trouble with that notion, and they're correct, too.
Well, let me pass this one by you. Several years ago, I lived in Peru for about 2 years, and I had the opportunity to work with a man who taught me the Aymara language. The Aymara people live on the high plateau of southern Peru by Lake Titicaca. And instead of saying, I'm going home, they would say, Utaharua, which in their language means my house and I are becoming one. How would you analyze that?
Isn't that interesting the way different languages convey basic concepts in different ways? And it's tempting to suppose that that means that the Aymara speaker is thinking differently. But how about this? If I say something like, I have a house, actually European languages are rather peculiar in having a word, a verb, to have, meaning to possess like that, that you use all the time. In a typical language in the world, you would say that the house is to me, or the house is of me. For people who know Russian, that'll seem familiar. Or you'll just say something like, I house, or something like that. To have this verb have, it's rather peculiar, because if you think about what is having, it's a very strange thing. And yet, I don't think that we would say that that means that Europeans are more conscious of possessing something than, say, someone in Mongolia. It just doesn't seem to hold up. So a lot of these things are interesting, but they're also arbitrary. They're a matter of chance. How a language encodes a concept to a large extent is a matter of how the ball happened to bounce. So there's a great diversity, but it's hard to say that it channels how people think.
So are we operating from the assumption then that the ability of our species to speak as we do, regardless of what language or tongue we speak, arose from a genetic mutation in the larynx of our ancestors long ago?
That is highly controversial. That's a very fertile grounds for research at this point, how language arose in the biological sense. There are those who think that our brains are configured to process language, and I think all would agree that our brains are processed to configure it in some way. Exactly how, if anything, becomes less clear rather than more clear as time goes by. Clearly, there's something having to do with the way that we manipulate our larynx and our tongue. There's something going on in the muscular sense, and there's even a gene for it called FOXP2, which has been identified. It differs only slightly in chimpanzees, and so it's thought that that genetic difference must have something to do with the fact that they cannot speak in the way that we do, although they can be taught to use sign language in a relatively simple but, you know, fascinating way. And so it would appear that there is some sort of genetic specification, and the fact that babies babble and that even deaf babies babble with their hands, it would seem that there is something inside of us, something inborn, that predisposes us to speak. But a great deal of the way any particular language comes out is obviously arbitrary. And so the fact that we call the four-legged barking animal a dog, that's not genetically specified. That's just an accident.
I'd like to put language into the concept of the several senses that we as human beings have and ask you about that. But first I want to say that on this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Professor John McWhorter of Columbia University about his recent book, Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. John, taking our senses and putting them into the abstraction of words that we use to communicate as you and I are now from California to New Jersey, how does that work?
In what sense, how does it work?
Well, the sense of we have both learned a common tongue in different parts of the of a place on Earth where we were exposed to that commonality. And we learn it presumably from childhood as a first language, listening to our parents.
That's right.
And now we're parsing it out. We're analyzing it. Perhaps I should ask, what is the purpose of the effort of analyzing it, of the parsing of the way we speak?
Well, I think that what we're doing right now is we are communicating according to an established set of correspondences between the spoken word, such as dog, and the concept, which we're taught, and ours, of course, is individual. There are 5,999 other languages, roughly, where that word is quite different. And then there are ways that we put the words together, ways that we have them refer to one another by the use of endings or smaller words, which are not about actual concrete content, but are grammatical traffic cops, so to speak. And that's what we're doing. And what's interesting about it is that it's hard to say exactly how we learn to do this, both so quickly and so well and with no effort. There's so much about what we're doing that we would have a hard time explaining to the foreigner. And so, for example, try explaining to somebody the difference between a and the. Or if you use a sentence along the lines of, well, he didn't even know that it was raining. Try to explain to a foreigner exactly what even means. It doesn't mean level. It's not that kind. Just what's the even? And yet we use words like that all the time. And it's a miraculous process because we do it without effort. It's something done without effort even by people who are uneducated. It's something done without effort even by people who are brain damaged often, if you think about it. You can have a kind of brain damage that impairs your language ability, but typically you don't. And so someone who's a raving lunatic will be using a word like even in that exact way. They couldn't tell you what it means, but they use it in a way that is quite recognizable to all of us. And so language is something that lends itself to that kind of analysis, and that's what a lot of linguistic science is about.
Then if we remove a primary sense, the sense of sight, Mm-hmm. And we talk about the dog or the perro or the perito or the Shane.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. How has that come to be known and transformed into a sound that we make with our mouth by a person who can't see the dog?
By a person who can't see the dog?
Yes.
Well, basically what you're talking about is a neurological process, and we only know so much about it, how it is that there are articulators, the parts of our body that we use to make these sounds, and how those are linked to mental images that we have, and then how we generate that, and then how this ends up creating that same image in someone else's mind. Not to mention the fact that generally we are not just saying dog. Generally we're encoding a whole sentence as well as personal nuance, and we're conveying that to the other person as well. That is an aspect of linguistic science that's studied by, for example, neurologists and people doing MRIs. That, for the record, is not what I do. I'm somebody who studies how languages change over time and what happens when they come into contact. But it's a fascinating area of study.
So let's dwell on how language has changed. When you identify the changes in language, staying within our common language within the United States and the colloquial variances throughout different regions, what information have you learned? This is an interesting conversation for me and hopefully for you and our listeners. But what do we do with this knowledge? How does it serve us?
Well, one of the ways that it serves us is that there is a general notion out there that the typical person runs around making linguistic errors. And it's a very reasonable way of thinking, because in our modern society, we have widespread literacy and we have widespread print. So there's a sense that there's a language on the page, and there's standards that have been set up, often quite arbitrarily and often 200 and 300 years ago, that we're taught are the way the language is supposed to be, often based on a conception that language is supposed to match up with logic in the mathematical sense. And the fact of the matter is that none of the 6,000 languages in the world are perfectly logical in that way. And none of the languages of the world ever have been perfectly logical in that way. And there's a degree of shagginess that all languages have. This becomes clearer if, one, you have a sense of how languages vary around the world and how full of dings and mistakes, so to speak, all of them are. And also if you look at just how language changes and how it always has, including our own language. So in one chapter of my book, Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, I write about how the sense that we have that something like Billy and me went to the store is a grievous error that a person is committing a venial sin in uttering because it, quote-unquote, doesn't make logical sense, doesn't cohere, because with every one of those things, there's something else in the language that doesn't make sense that no one minds, such as the fact that we don't say amant. And so, I am a man. Amant I? Shouldn't it be that instead of aren't I? Because I would never say I are a man. And so no one thinks about that. That's just accepted. And there's no logical reason why the other things that people tend to pick on as illogical should be singled out. It's really just that language is a shaggy thing. So one aspect of why linguistics can be useful that is in the book that I wrote is that particular aspect of things. That's not what the whole book concerns, but that's one chapter that I use after I've discussed some things about how English developed that we don't often hear.
When we talk about linguistic errors, how would you classify the sentence, where are you at, instead of where are you?
You know, what's interesting about that is that deciding what part of speech at would be is very challenging. And so there's a whole issue of grammatical analysis. People could write impenetrable linguistic papers about the analysis of where are you at. None of them would have any logical or scientific grounds for saying that where are you at is incorrect. It's just a different way of saying where are you. And what's interesting about where are you at is that that is a grammatical sentence in probably more varieties of spoken English than it isn't. Standard English does not happen to have it, but it seems to pop up in the way this descendant of Old English is spoken in just about every place that it's used, for example, in England itself, and then here in the United States in all of our colloquial varieties. And so just on that basis alone, that doesn't really set the case firmly. But one might argue if this is what everyone does, then how plausible is the explanation that "where are you" somehow has pride of place because that happens to be the way it's said in the dialect that happened to be the one that wound up in the shop window as the standard variety. So the standard variety is great, but the other varieties developed alongside it, not from it. And so they weren't degradations of the standard. They were just other puppies in the brood.
Then how about something else that seems to have developed in the past decade or so? When someone says thank you, instead of the response being "you're welcome," the response has come to be "no problem."
Mm-hmm. And this is a problem. Why?
Well, I'm just wondering the change. I hear
right.
that difference as,
right.
well, you really haven't bothered me when you've come into my store to purchase something.
Right.
Being addressed to the person who leaves saying thank you for selling it to me.
That's right. And what's interesting about that is that that is what is sometimes known as an exchange pair. And they're all sorts of highly formulaic things that are said between people, where really what's being done is establishing a kind of courtesy or establishing a kind of acknowledgement. And the correspondence between the function and the actual words can be quite approximate. And so, for example, if someone says thank you to me, I'll often go, mm-hmm. And the mm-hmm technically is some sort of assent, but I'm not trying to express, yes, indeed, you thank me, or something like that. I'm just acknowledging it. And the fact is that I could theoretically acknowledge it by sticking two of my fingers up into the air, or I could lift up a leg or something like that. And so that kind of approximate correspondence between literal meaning and what the function of what we're saying is can be quite common. It's part of how language changes. And those things, of course, are different from decade to decade, from century to century, although with no problem, I wouldn't be surprised if you could put a microphone on someone in a store in 1905 and hear "no problem" being used in the same way. But I have no scientific basis for that.
In your experience, I'm wondering if it's similar to mine. Have you heard an increase in your part of America where people would say "no problem" instead of "you're welcome"?
No, I haven't. I haven't been listening. It might be people do say "no problem" all the time. I'm sure I've said it. I'm not sure what the dates are on it because I don't think anybody has happened to be tabulating it.
So what promotes this kind of change?
Well, you know, some of this kind of change really is a matter of randomness. And that's not just a cop-out. It's just that there are various directions that a language might go, various words that might be recruited for some function and that end up losing their meaning, such as when people use "no problem" in that way. And in general, there's a process in language where something that has a literal meaning ends up having instead just a function. And what I mean by that, for example, is that in 1400, if you said, "I'm going to read a book," what that would mean is I'm going to remove myself from this location and put myself in one where there is a book and read it. There's the literal meaning. But the fact is that if you are going to locomote somewhere in order to do something, that implies that the doing of that thing is going to happen in the future. That's an implication that stands in it. Those implications have a way of changing how we use a word. And so over the centuries, gradually, "I'm going to" started to mean the future. So that by, say, 1650, 1700, if you said, "I'm going to read a book," you did not mean that you were going to get up and go to where the book was. You meant that in the future, you were going to read a book. So "go" no longer had a literal meaning. And when you say "I'm going to" or "gonna," you're not talking about locomotion. You're talking about the future. That was not special. That was a typical process in how words are used. And so "dog" meaning simply "dog," that's basic, that's 101. But in terms of how we actually put sentences together, there are the other words that have lost their literal meaning. That loss of literal meaning is something that also happens when we use words in salutary or polite fashion. And so that's the sort of thing that happens when "no problem" develops.
How about the fact that in the 14th century there were a lot fewer books available than there are now?
I don't think that would have had to do with it because I talked about reading, but I was just choosing a random verb. But if you would have said something like, you know, "I'm going to sleep," "I'm going to sleep in this bed," you would have gotten up and gone to sleep in that bed. Whereas now I can tell you "I'm going to sleep in that bed," And what I mean, what I likely mean, is in the future, the bed I'm going to sleep in is that one. I'm not talking about the locomotion. That's a process that's called grammaticalization by linguists, and it's how a lot of English as we know it, and any language as we know it, has developed.
Well, John McWhorter, author of Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I have a couple of questions, as usual. One is, what's an important concept or idea that you've learned recently?
Recently, an important concept or idea that I have learned.
And recently is also a transitory time. It can be long ago in our realm.
Sure. One thing that I learned, and I guess we can completely switch gears here, is that I have a second line as a commentator on race. And I think that the election of Barack Obama showed that the idea that there's a certain core of person out there who would not vote for Barack Obama, and that it meant that there is an ingrained racism in this country that could keep us from having a black president, that has been shown not to be true. And it's something that I always suspected, but it's something that I saw confirmed a month ago, and it's really given me a lot to chew on. So that's the honest answer.
And the other question is, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
The best book I've read over the past few months would be Ethan Mordden's new biography of Florenz Ziegfeld, the theater impresario, Ziegfeld Follies, Showboat, etc. That's something that I just have always had a side interest in. And Mordden has written a biography of that man that makes you feel like you're living his life. It's also not too long, which biographies tend to be. And I think he did a really fine job. It was one of those potato chip books that I could not put down. So I recommend it to anybody who's interested in show business and how it developed.
Well, John McWhorter, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Professor John McWhorter is the author of Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English. The book that Professor McWhorter recommends is Ziegfeld Follies, The Man Who Invented Show Business, by Ethan Mordden, M-O-R-D-D-E-N. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.